This is Kids These Days.
Today, we're talking about family law. We'll hear from a local legal expert who's written a handbook to help Alaskans navigate through the state's legal system on family matters. Kids These Days contributor Jessica Cochran gives us the scoop on affordable legal services available for families in need. We'll learn about what it takes to become emancipated if you're a teenager in our state, and advice about helping kids through divorce from Ask KTD. That's a new feature we're debuting today. All that and more coming right up. I'm talking with Anchorage family law attorney Stephen Pradel about family law in our state this hour on Kids These Days. I'm your host, Shanna Sheehy, but let's first set the stage by talking about what legal services are out there for people in financial need. Hiring an attorney to handle legal matters may seem like the only option in some situations, but what do you do if you just can't afford to do that? There are a variety of organizations that help represent low-income Alaskans in legal matters, and some resources that help people do some of the work themselves. Kids These Days contributor Jessica Cochran has more.
Ryan Fortson is on break from a class he's teaching at the Fairview Recreation Center. Across from the gym, in a much smaller room, his students are gathered around a table, looking through a packet of forms, learning how to tally and divide up their marital possessions. The class is a clinic on divorce. It's offered by Alaska Legal Services Corporation, where Fortson is an attorney.
We don't, in these clinics, give specific legal advice to parents about their specific legal situation. We give general advice about what they might anticipate when filing a divorce or a custody action. And to the extent that we can, we try to tell them how they might encounter and approach different situations.
The divorce clinic is offered the second Wednesday of every month. A child custody clinic is offered on the third Wednesday of the month. Fortson says some of the people who attend may need legal representation, but with a little coaching, most can get through the process themselves.
And so that's the purpose of these clinics is, again, to enable people to fill out the forms themselves, get the process started. The courts are certainly, and judges are certainly used to situations where litigants come without an attorney to do a divorce or a custody action, and uniformly the judges are very understanding and very capable of handling litigants who don't have attorneys.
Alaska Legal Services does offer attorney services to low-income Alaskans who meet eligibility requirements, with incomes no higher than 125% of federal poverty guidelines.
Alaska Legal Services handles a wide variety of cases for low-income Alaskans. In addition to divorce and custody actions, we do domestic violence protective orders. We also do landlord-tenant cases. We only represent tenants, not landlords. And we do some public benefits work, Medicaid, food stamps. We have an attorney who sometimes does wills.
Other agencies also offer help. Krista Scully, pro bono director for the Alaska Bar Association, says most of the programs have an income cap for eligibility. Some target specific types of cases. The Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault works statewide to help people involved in domestic violence situations get legal representation. Others include the Alaska Native Justice Center and the Disability Law Center.
Disability Law Center helps folks with issues having to do with their disability, so that could be special education, could be public benefits, could be an employment access issue.
Scully says while the choices may be confusing, the agencies in Alaska work together well.
In Alaska, our organizations do a really extraordinary job of working together, collaborating as much as possible, whether that's through joint funding applications or working together on upcoming projects and how they can best support one another, if there are resources that can be shared. For example, one organization helps provide malpractice insurance policy for the other organizations so that attorneys who volunteer automatically become covered by that policy.
Scully's role also includes policy work to make it easier for attorneys to do pro bono work. One recent change waives Bar Association dues for retired or non-practicing attorneys who do only volunteer work. According to Bar Association guidelines, all attorneys are supposed to offer 50 hours of pro bono or volunteer work per year.
We know of about 300 to 400 attorneys that give a minimum of 50 hours per year. And we also know that there's a tremendous amount of pro bono that kind of goes on under the radar. And by under the radar, I mean is not connected to one of the legal services providers that I mentioned or that's on our website.
There is also a generous amount of information available online. The Alaska Court System's Family Law Self-Help Center is a web or telephone-based service with forms and instructions for a wide variety of situations. You can link to that site and find other resources on our website, kidsthesedays.org. I'm Jessica Cochran.
Today on Kids These Days, we're talking about family law. What do Alaskans need to know about what's within the law in our state? Well, to learn about just that, we have Stephen Pradel in the studio today. Stephen Pradel is an Anchorage attorney who owns and operates Pradel & Associates. Pradel earned a law degree from the University of Oregon School of Law. He's been practicing law in Alaska for nearly 25 years and is a member of the domestic section of the Alaska Bar Association. Several years ago, Steve Pradel wrote the Alaska Family Law Handbook. It's a guide for people who need to know what to do when they face issues like divorce, custody, mediation, and many more legal challenges. Thanks a lot for being here with us on Kids These Days today.
My pleasure.
It's really great to have you in the studio. Maybe I can start off this conversation by asking you a question about where the idea or the need came from to write a book such as the Alaska Family Law Handbook.
I've been writing articles for folks for a number of years for different publications. And after doing that, I just sort of stepped back and saw that number one, there was really no other publication that addressed Alaska family law. And number two, the articles themselves covered many topics that might be of interest to Alaskans. And so I stepped back a little further and figured out what else needed to be in there. And then a book was formed.
And so I think it was published for the first time, it looked like about 10 years ago. Is that correct?
A little over a decade ago.
Okay. And then so have you been updating it and keeping it fresh for people, so to speak?
Well, there's a couple places that do need to be updated. That child support changes quite often, and there's a new area on domestic violence that's sort of changed the nature of how Alaska judges handle the situation. And so when people come in and talk about those things, I give them one of the two sections that have been updated depending on what their issues are. So one should never rely on any legal book as being timely. So the book is mostly helpful and informative, and it's not written to give legal advice in a particular situation.
But it is a really good place for someone to start. And I know, I think it's the very first part of your book says that it's important for a person or families to really be selective when they seek an attorney. Can you tell me a little bit about how someone might go through that process and then why you think it's important that they choose someone with do that in a really specific way?
Sure. Well, I've had cancer myself, and I understand the nature of finding someone that can help to change your life. And when you need an attorney in your life, it's almost as important as having a doctor, because you need someone that can guide you and steer you in a place where you're kind of confused and really don't know what the answers are. And so it's not a bad idea to sit in a lawyer's office and sort of get a feeling for that person, and don't just go with the first one that you see if you have any doubts or questions, and make sure that you come prepared with your questions and have them answered to your to your liking. And if you feel at the end of the conversation that you and that person aren't communicating effectively, try somebody else. Because when you're sitting there in that courtroom with the hardest decisions that need to be made in your life, you better be feeling pretty good about that person, that they're thinking about you, that they're listening to you. And an interview works both ways. The lawyer's interviewing the client, the same time the client's interviewing the lawyer, and both have to feel good about that relationship, or else that lawyer's probably not going to be that much help for you in the long run.
And now you are a family practice lawyer, that's correct, right?
Primarily, I do family law. I do a little bit of a few other things, but mostly that's where my practice is.
And so in the 25 years or so that you have been in that practice, mm-hmm. what would you say are the most, like what are the most common family law issues that come up, or clients who seek your help, what are they seeking help for?
Sure. And my book is probably more of a custody book than anything else. People who go through divorces have other issues. They have issues that deal with property division and other things. But most of the time we're talking about what's best for children, and we call that the best interest of the child. And there's some side issues, and most issues also have child support components and, you know, who has the PFD and all the sort of secondary issues. But mostly it's where should kids live and how much time should kids spend with each parent or whomever ends up being the person that the court decides is best for the child.
So can you maybe tell us a little bit about the law with respect to custody? I read that there are maybe two, maybe more different kinds of custody. There's shared custody and sole custody. Are those as easy as they seem in terms of the words that we use to describe those?
Well, the words are very complicated, and they mean different things in different contexts. There's basically two kinds of custody from one approach, and that is legal custody versus physical custody. And physical custody means, where do kids live? Do the children live equally with each parent? Are they sharing physical custody? Or does the child live primarily with one parent? And depending on how many overnights they have, it's sole custody. And it's all kind of intertwines with the child support amount, too, because it's based, in a sense, on where do kids sleep at night and how much time are they spending with each parent. And the second type of custody, aside from physical custody, is legal custody. And what that means mostly is who makes the decisions about the children? Do we make them together, two parents? Do they talk about it and both have an equal say? Or does one parent have sole legal custody, which means that they get to decide where a child goes to school, which doctors the child sees, whether they have braces or a tattoo or get a bar mitzvah or baptism? There are major decisions in children's lives, and sharing legal custody is preferred, but parents really have to communicate well in order for a court to find that it's in the best interest.
And so is it possible then to have there be physical custody for one parent, but then legal custody of another parent? Does that ever happen?
You know, lots of different things happen. And I was in a case that I can remember where a judge gave legal custody to one parent and physical custody to the other. So, yes, there's no requirement that one travels with the other.
And so explain for me also, you know, why is it the case, I think you said, I should paraphrase you and tell me if this is right, but in most cases, it's best to have it be shared legal custody between two parents. You know, why does the Alaska court system feel that that's the case?
Well, the court system gets its marching orders from the legislature, and the Alaska legislature has said on different occasions that it feels that both parents should, as long as it's practicable and it's not bad for the children, not detrimental to their best interest in the legal terminology, that parents should share custody as much as they can. It's not always possible. Alaska is a big state. We have people living thousands of miles away from each other in this one state, and then the lower 48 and other parts of the world. So that can't always happen. But to the extent that it works, shared custody, shared physical custody, generally is in the best interest of children.
So let's do a little bit of time traveling. Like, let's imagine, I mean, we're talking about a judge deciding matters of custody, physical custody, legal custody. But if we travel back in time to, you know, a particular family and when they might start the process that brings them to that point, what kinds of disputes are in play when you end up in front of a judge talking about the custody of your children? Like, how does a family get there?
Well, you can resolve your issues in a number of ways. If you're married and are thinking about getting a divorce, you can either go to court and have somebody else decide everything for you, which isn't always best, or you can try to figure it out yourself. And there's a form that you can get from the court that's called a dissolution form, and they're available online too. And this might be a good time to talk about the Alaska Family Law Self-Help Center. It's a relatively new development in Alaska. It's a very helpful place where you can find it by Googling it. And there's lots of forms, and there's people that can answer procedural questions. It's a branch of the court system where people are there that are trained to help people, guide them through the process. They're not lawyers, or even if they are, they're not allowed to give legal advice. But they are allowed to help people pick the right form and understand what a court proceeding is like, and offer them tips on how to prepare their case for trial. So going back to your question, if parents are able to communicate well, they can either do a dissolution if they are married, and if they're not married, they can come up with some kind of a custody agreement. There's a model parenting agreement that a Fairbanks judge created. It's about 25 pages long. It's got some instructions which are helpful, and it kind of goes through many of the issues that parents have, and it gives them three or four different choices, and if they can't figure out which one's the right one, they can write their own. And that's another way of sort of getting educated and working with somebody else to try to resolve your issues. If you can't do it, and oftentimes people get to a deadlock and they can't figure it out, that's where a judge comes in. Judges are available to hear cases, and they hear probably more custody kinds of cases than any other kind of case. Believe it or not, they may not like it, but that's our caseload is pretty full of custody matters, and the family law lawyers in Anchorage and in Alaska stay pretty busy.
It's important to decide what is going to happen for those children, obviously.
Absolutely.
So I'd like to remind listeners that you're listening to Kids These Days. Today in the studio, we have Steve Pradell. He is an Anchorage lawyer, and he's written a book called The Alaska Family Law Handbook. And the self-help center he just referred to will be something you can find at our website, and that's at kidstheseDays.org, and you'll be able to link to that from our site. So there's divorce and dissolution. These things are different. Is that right?
Well, the net effect of a dissolution is the same as a divorce, but you can't walk into a courtroom for a 15-minute hearing with issues that you have a problem with. Basically, it's a contract. If you and the other person, your wife, your husband, can solve all of the issues, then you fill out that form, and there are instructions there too, and you go in, and in 15 minutes, hopefully you'll get a master to listen to you, ask the right questions, and approve of your dissolution, and then you get a dissolution, which, as I said, is the same effect as a divorce, a lot less expensive, and maybe more productive.
So it pays to agree, it sounds like.
Absolutely.
And then where there are children concerned, then there might also be an additional step where custody matters are a part of that, or is that part of that initial dissolution?
Well, the form itself, and this brings up a good topic, the form itself has a half a page on the visitation agreement or arrangements. You can actually put something on the back of that form, the agreement that I talked about, the 25-page model parenting agreement, could be attached to a dissolution agreement. And so the two documents together could be approved by a judge, which means that if you wanted much more detail than just a little bit here and a little bit there, then you'd fill that all out. There is a box that people could check on the form that says, oh, we think we can figure everything out. We don't want to work it out here. We'll be able to work it out later. And let me tell you, if you want to hire me later and you want to buy my boat, which I don't have at the moment, then feel free to check that box off, because something's going to happen in your life that's going to change. You're going to have a new person in your life that other person doesn't like. Anything can happen, and emotions get high. It's better to put something in there as a fallback plan, so that if you don't agree on everything, if you don't figure stuff out day to day, at least you have a set of rules that can guide you. So I think that's a good way to avoid lawyers, is to figure out what that basic model is and don't just check off that box. But, you know, again, today's not legal advice. If people want to check the box off, that's fine. They might be in my office down the road.
What happens even if you don't check off that I'll decide on this stuff later box and you go through dissolution paperwork that is accepted and there you go, you're divorced, you're no longer, or you're separated and you're no longer legally married and so forth. What if you have, what if you regret some of those choices that you make in the future? Is there anything you can do about changing that agreement? Can you go back to the courts? What options might somebody have in that kind of a case?
There are ways to change custody. When you sue somebody for X amount of money in a car crash, for example, usually when you're done, you're done. You can't go back, and you probably sign a release that says, hey, I'm accepting this much money and I'm never going back. But children they're changing targets. I mean, they don't just stay static. And many times custody cases go back to court when circumstances change. And the key is whether there's been a substantial change of circumstances. If it's going to be a child custody problem and a material change of circumstances, if there's going to be a change in child support, and both of those things are subject to change.
And as ever, that you talked about the physical custody and you talk about the legal custody. Do you have to go if say, for example, a child is living with a mother in one case and then later on it becomes better for the child and for the family to have that child living with the father? Is that the kind of thing you have to go back to the courts for?
Well, people can come up with agreements to modify their custody matters without having to have a judge decide. And an agreement is also called a stipulation. And if people can come up with an agreement through working with each other or through lawyers or through a process called mediation, which we might want to talk about at some point, then they can ask a judge to approve their agreement. And it's, again, a lot faster and less expensive if everybody thinks it's great for little Ann to move into Dad's house for a year and try it. Wonderful. If people fight about it, then you know little Ann is not going to be very happy just because she sees her family fighting. And some parents don't pay a lot of attention to that. But the effect of a child who goes through a long series of custody fights can be pretty detrimental.
Do you observe that in the job that you have? Do you see kids who are sort of in the middle of a big, difficult, angry time and see them suffering?
Well, the irony about being a custody lawyer or a family law lawyer is that you generally don't invite the kids into your office. I mean, there are rare exceptions where that might be appropriate, but in general, you hear about children. There are professionals out there that actually meet with children and talk to judges about that, and those could be counselors or custody investigators or guardians ad litem, which are sort of they're like a custody investigator, but they have a little bit of a different focus. There are professionals, as I said, that can listen to children and tell a judge what they think is best. And the children go into their offices. They're more in the therapy area. Children probably don't belong in lawyers' offices very much.
And are those resources you're talking about for the children, they're available in the state of Alaska, I would assume? And how might a family find out about those or get access to those?
Right. If there's a complicated custody issue, which isn't just your simple run-of-the-mill issue, folks can ask a judge to appoint a custody investigator. If their income is low enough, they don't reach a certain threshold, and that number changes over time as well, then they may qualify for a no-cost custody investigator, and the state would provide that. And they're located in Anchorage anyway at the courthouse. There may be other locations around the state. If parties have enough resources, a court can have them hire a private person who, there are professional custody investigators with lots of training that are available that can do it for a fee. They charge usually by the hour.
You're listening to Kids These Days on KSKA 91.1 FM. We're in the studio with Steve Pradell. He's of Pradell & Associates. He's a family law lawyer here in Anchorage. And I'm your host, Shanna Sheehy. And Steve Pradell is answering questions about family law in Alaska for us on Kids These Days today. So, Steve, can you tell us about mediation and what it is in comparison to some of these other things we've been talking about?
Well, the role of mediation has really changed, I think, since I started. It was around way back then, but over the years, it's become a much more important tool that courts have used because there's really so many people going through this process, and the court system just can't handle trials on all these issues. And I think the judges have come to find that if people resolve their own problems and they have a hand in what it is that's going to happen, they're generally much more comfortable. It may not be perfect, but certainly they helped to create that and they agreed to it. Mediation is a process where you find a neutral person that can help you to solve your problem. That person can be but doesn't have to be a lawyer. And you go there not for purposes of getting legal advice, but for purposes of trying to come to an agreement. And the good part about mediation is sort of a double-edged sword, is that you don't have to agree. It's not forced. Arbitration's another word, but the difference between the two is an arbitrator acts like a judge. They tell you, I'm deciding this. A mediator doesn't have that role. They sit there, they listen to one side, they listen to the other, and they try to come to peace between the two sides. And the sign of a good mediation, I tell my clients, is when both sides are equally unhappy. Because nobody really wins in custody cases. There's no clear winner. Everybody gets something. You may not get exactly what you want, but hopefully you get what you and the child need.
And so you said a mediator or someone who does mediation can be a lawyer, or they could be someone else. Does that have to be someone who, say, a counselor? Do they have to have some sort of professional qualification for that?
I'm not so sure in Alaska that is regulated to that extent, but to become a good mediator and get referrals from people like me, you have to sort of have some background. There are some mediators that are financial planners, for example, or have a social work background. They can get the job done. Are people going in with complicated property issues? Do they need to know about complicated retirements? Do they need to know about valuations of things? Do they need to know about custody? Do they need to know about child support? Mediators have background, and that background can help people to solve their problems.
Well, let's go into, you just mentioned child support, and I feel like maybe we could stand to hear a little bit more about how child support is determined. How is it put together so that it's decided which parent pays how much on a monthly basis and so forth in Alaska?
Well, child support's a sort of a very complicated area. They've written a large civil rule called Civil Rule 90.3 with a commentary, and you read that whole thing and you've read a lot. And there's the idea behind child support is to make everything standard, but every person is not the same as everybody else, and everybody's income is a little different unless you work for a steady Eddie job where you get a paycheck. And so there are a lot of exceptions and questions. In general, child support depends on where the children spend their time. And there's certain words that are like the custody words that apply differently to child support. For example, a parent has primary custody for child support purposes. That means the kids live with them the most, not 51%, but more than 70% of the time. If kids live with one parent so that the other parent doesn't see the children overnight for 110 overnights a year, then the parent who doesn't have the kids has to pay the other parent a pure percentage of whatever their net income is. If the parents are within that sort of 70-30, 60-40, or 50-50 gap, then they share custody. And basically, a percentage of one parent's income supports the other parent during the other parent's time, and a percentage of the other parent's income supports the children when they're with that first parent, in a formula that's too complicated to describe right now. But you get the idea, is that the court's trying to fairly figure out some way of allocating support so that it covers those children.
And so it sounds like if it's less than 70, if one parent has the children or the child for less than 30% of the time,
right,
then there's this straight off the top percentage that goes to the parent who has a child for 70% or more of the time. Mm-hmm. But when it's closer to an even sharing, then there's some other formula that comes in to factor that out. But maybe the essence of it is that it's kind of canceling itself
right
out, because the parents are sort of sharing the financial responsibility along with the time responsibility.
Well, let's take an example. I think you've got it. For one child, if you, let's say you're the mother and I'm the father, let's just pretend, and I have the child most of the time and you have less than 110 overnights, then you've got to pay me 20% of your net income because I'm the one with that child. Now, if we were sharing that child, let's say 50-50, which is the easiest example, then in general, you'd be paying me 20% for half the time, and I'd be paying you 20% for half the time, and then one person might be making more money, and so we'd subtract the bigger from the smaller, and then for some reason, they multiply the payors by 1.5%. They think that the person who has to pay needs to pay a little more. I don't know exactly why they do that, but that's how the shared custody formula works. In a very simple setting, it does get more complicated depending on a lot of factors.
You're listening to Kids These Days on this listener-supported station. Today's conversation is about Alaska family law. I'm speaking with Anchorage family law attorney and Alaska family law handbook author, Stephen Pradell. We'll hear more of our conversation after the break. Still coming this hour, find out what it takes to become an emancipated minor in our state and hear advice about handling divorce when kids are involved from our Ask KTD counselor. Stay with us. We'll be back in a minute.
Our little boy is 4 years old and quite a little man. So we spell out the words we don't want him to understand. Like T-O-Y or maybe S-U-R-P-R-I-S-E. But the words we're hiding from him now tear the heart right out of me. Our D-I-V-O-R-C-E becomes final today. Me and little J-O-E will be going away. I love you both, and this will be
It's state high school basketball tournament time again. So next time on Kids These Days, we're talking all about competitive youth sports. We'll learn about the Alaska School Activities Association, hear from coaches, and find out about a new Paralympic program in our region. Plus, we'll explore some alternative forms of sporting open to youth. That and more on Kids These Days. I'm Shanna Sheehy. Join me Tuesday at 2 and again at 7 p.m. right here on KSKA. This is Kids These Days. I'm Shanna Sheehy. We're back with the second half of our program about Alaska family law. I'm in the studio today with Stephen Pradell. Steve is a family law attorney here in Anchorage.
Steve, I wanted to ask you also, we've talked a lot about custody, we've talked about mediation, we've talked about a lot of interesting things that are all in your Alaska Family Law Handbook. Mm-hmm. But there are some things that you talk about in there that you mentioned there that I wanted to ask you about since you're in the studio. For example, I wanted to ask about, there's a section on child abuse, and I'm wondering, can you tell listeners how you might proceed if you're looking to protect a child from an abusive parent or family member, or someone maybe who's not even a family member?
Sure. And this is an area that has a lot of different subparts and would get much more complicated than a short-term talk today. But, you know, if there's an immediate emergency, call the police. But if there is, if you need something that done quickly, if you think that someone is committing a crime involving domestic violence that has to do with a child, you can go to court and try to get a restraining order. You know, the Office of Children's Services, OCS, is another branch of our government that is there to investigate abuse types of claims. As I was talking about, I think, at the beginning of our talk, the custody factors have changed since I wrote my book a while ago. Domestic violence has now become an issue that if you can prove that a parent has what's called a history of domestic violence, then normally there's 9 factors that a court looks at in figuring out custody. But the domestic violence factor, the legislature has said, is so important, and I think our governor has tried to put that at the top of one of his priorities, basically all the other factors get trumped. And if a judge finds that someone has a history of domestic violence, that judge has to do certain things to address that without thinking about the normal 50-50 type of deal. Certain things have to happen with legal custody and physical custody, and there may be supervised visitation that's required, and there may be a need to go to a batterer's intervention, domestic violence classes, and some other things to address those issues, because now they've risen from just one of many factors to a major factor. If that exists, and a lawyer can prove that, or a person who doesn't have a lawyer can prove it to a judge, then the judge has to deal with that more than anything at that moment.
It's interesting to me that that's something that's obviously it's not new. It was one of the factors before, but that its elevation to being a factor that sort of trumps all others is a relatively new development.
Yeah, it's within the last decade, things have changed. And it's been hard, I think, for judges initially who were used to looking at all the factors and making what they thought were good decisions about kids to being told now that this factor has to take much more weight because, you know, there are certain cases where that is absolutely appropriate and other cases where a judge may have a little bit of a different belief. So that particular pill didn't go down that easily. But the Alaska Supreme Court has said, you know, the rule means what it says and everyone needs to follow it and the judges are following it. And the lawyers are then, you know, every time a new rule comes down, we have to change our way of looking at a case to see if there's a different argument that we can make to protect the children.
I'm wondering also about parents who are not married. How does it work in terms of parental rights if parents are unmarried and then they're also seeking to not be involved with one another anymore?
Sure. We talked about the dissolution before with married couples. A custody case, the fact that parents are married really doesn't change the way a court looks at things. If two unmarried parents have a child, for the most part, the same rules are going to apply to how child support is issued and how custody is determined. It may be a little harder to find the right form because, you know, a divorce has, you know, this dissolution form is designed for that. But there are forms that are available that help people to decide these things. And, you know, in the old days, the courts may have had a preference about whether a woman or a man was more important. And in Alaska, that's not the issue today. Both parents stand before the court as equals unless the court finds that there's some good reason to change things. So in unmarried couples, parents have the same rights that that married couples would have. The facts may be a little different, but the factors are the same.
In your book, you mention some commandments that a particular judge gave to divorcing parents. Could you describe those? I found those to be very interesting.
Well, every once in a while, there will be different folks that come up with strategies. And let me just talk about an update to that. I just went to a meeting with a couple of private custody investigators who are very good, and they have been doing it probably for as long as anybody in the state. And they sat down with all the family law lawyers, and they came down with sort of their list of do's and don'ts of family law, which is a little similar to what I've got published there. And, you know, parents make a lot of mistakes when they go through this stuff. It's a very emotional roller coaster issue. You're dealing with another parent that used to be your best friend, is now your enemy. And if you're in litigation, then really it can be a war depending on how the fight is fought. It could be very peaceful, but it can also be, you know, litigation is no picnic. And so I've had parents make those mistakes, and then they pay for them in court. You know, parents sometimes talk to the children about the litigation and try to get them involved. And often that is a no-no. Parents sometimes will try to pass messages through the child to the other parent and to try to use the child as a pawn in between the other parents. And that, too, can backfire. Sometimes parents will what's called disparage or badmouth the other parent right in front of a child. And that parent may not know how detrimental it is. Maybe that parent never went through a divorce. But kids pick up on everything. They know their parents are going through a tough process, and it trickles down to them, and maybe even a lot harder than the parents. They don't have that hard shell. They haven't learned to be adults yet. And so everything that a parent does is going to be affecting those children. If they leave the litigation lying around and a kid finds it and starts reading what the other parent has said, that can be really harmful. In addition to all the normal bad things that parents do to kids, physically abusive or domestic violence, just involving them a lot in the process of the divorce can be not in their best interests. And parents have to be very diligent when they're going through a hard time just to try to keep their own issues separate from the issues of their children and deal with each one as it should be in a separate position.
I'll remind everyone, we're listening to Kids These Days, and today in the studio is attorney Steve Pradell. He's with Pradell & Associates, and he's a 25-year-long Alaska family law lawyer. And he's written a book called The Alaska Family Law Handbook, and he's answering lots of general questions about how to take care of yourself and your family when it comes to family law in the state of Alaska. This is Kids These Days. We've been talking a whole lot about children, and we've been talking about families and the law and how it relates to children in custody and so on and so forth. But there are some other, you know, family-related type law issues, like, for example, prenuptial and postnuptial agreements. Tell me a little bit about why someone might want one or both of those things.
Well, a moment ago, I mentioned that, you know, you spend an hour or two in a lawyer's office and it might save you a lot of money and time later. Prenuptial and postnuptial agreements are things that the Alaska Supreme Court has looked at and decided that, especially for people that, you know, have had a life, which a lot of people have when they get married again, maybe they already have children, maybe they've accumulated a lot of wealth, maybe one person is wealthy and they're marrying somebody that isn't. Sometimes people like to get together either before, which is the prenuptial, or after, which is the postnuptial, before or after they get married, and come to agreements on, if we ever got divorced, heaven forbid, how do we want this to get done so that it's not going to be a nasty, terrible fight? As long as a prenuptial agreement meets certain basic requirements, for the most part, that it's fair, that nobody forced somebody to do it, that people had the ability to, for example, get legal advice and, you know, all the different things that make things fair, a court may look very strongly on it. And they're a good idea, I think, for people, especially not the 18, not necessarily, but they could do it too, the 18-year-olds fresh out of high school starting with nothing that are joined at the hip for life, but for people that have already had a life that want to make sure that the children from their first marriage are going to be protected rather than the children from the second or whatever. There are other ways of structuring certain kinds of things, but a prenuptial or a postnuptial agreement can really make people sleep a little better if they've thought that through.
And is that your experience too, that it's not necessarily the first, the younger, you know, this is their first time being married type folks who seek that kind of counsel? Is it most often in your experience people who are maybe entering into a second marriage or maybe even a third marriage, or, you know, just are more mature in life and have more in terms of assets?
Generally, that's my experience, although there's nothing that prevents anybody who's getting married to have one, and or anybody who is married to come up with that agreement. Sometimes they're a little frightening for people because you don't want to think about, it's sort of like you don't want to do a will because you're not thinking about your death. But if you've been around for a while and you realize that it's going to happen, it might not be a bad idea to draft a will so that people aren't fighting about what they thought you meant or that the state is doing it instead of you. So the prenuptial agreement, probably people that are have been through the process before and just never want to go through that same awful battle want to do it a little easier. And maybe, just maybe, having a prenuptial agreement will make people sleep at night because they're not worried about somebody taking more than what they should take because they already know what they're going to get or what the other person's going to get, hopefully, if a court approves of that agreement.
So the approval from the court comes after that marriage is in its point of breaking up. Is that the case?
Right. It's a prenuptial or postnuptial agreement is a contract, and you the folks would have it drafted, hopefully reviewed by a lawyer or their own lawyers, I'd say. Each one should have their own lawyer in the best possible scenario and understand, get their own questions answered. But you always run a risk because if you get a divorce a year from then, it might still be fair and equitable. And 50 years from now, who knows? The laws could change. The situations may change. And you never know what any judge in a given day is going to do. You know, so it gives you a little more peace of mind, but there are no absolutes.
Well, let me ask you about wills. In fact, you just brought that up. Let's talk about wills. How important are they for family members, parents in particular?
Well, sometimes people think that they can, you know, this is a good question because it ties into something we talked about earlier. Parents think that if they put in their will that custody is going to go to their second cousin if they die, then that's not necessarily going to be what happens. You can't really, what happens in a will is hopefully if it's valid and everything's done right, then when you die, whatever you have goes to whoever you say it's going to go to. You could set up certain trusts if you have a lot of money and your children are minors, and you don't want your 16-year-old kid suddenly to have $1 million because they're going to spend it in ways that are going to really mess them up. One thing you can put in a will is that if I die before my children become a certain age, it doesn't have to be 18, could be some other age, you decide, it's your will, then you'll hand them their money in a certain way or make somebody else the guardian of that money, holding that trust for their benefit, someone that you trust. So there are ways that, you know, you can affect your family even from the grave if you draft a will carefully.
In the case of maybe of a young family, so we're talking about little kids, and maybe not $1 million to put in trust, what is the importance of a will in the case of just kind of a more simple situation? Is there an argument to be made that you should have a will if you're in a more simple sort of young family situation?
You know, I think a will is a good idea for most people that are going through their lives. You can always change a will. A will is a living and breathing document. You don't do one day and that's the one that has to stay. You could change a will the day before you die, as long as you're in your right mind. And but it makes you sort of think about things. You know, what if what do I want to do with my stuff? If you're married, it may be easy. You may want to give it all to your spouse. And if you have kids, you may want to let your spouse give it to the kids. And unless that person dies first, and then you want to give it to your kids in a certain way. But if you leave what's called your estate and you leave it in a way that's messy, oftentimes you read about, or if you're in my profession, sometimes you see that the worst things in people come out when people die. The relatives come out and take stuff, and you know, sometimes the people that should get everything don't. And there are battles that leave scars forever. And so if you can set up, even if you don't have a lot, if you can set up the idea of what you want to have happen when you die, the kind of way you want to distribute whatever wealth that you have or might have, because your will today could affect all the stuff you get for the rest of your life, then you might want to give it a try, and just so that you have it somewhere, because anybody can have a heart attack or get hit on a bus. Life is short. And as I think I said, I'm a cancer survivor, and you learn that even at whatever age, you might not be here forever.
And how best can someone, can a family seek counsel for a will so that it's done in a way that is going to last and stand up to the legal system when someone dies?
Well, there are two types of wills in a general sense. There's wills for people that don't have so much that the government's going to come out and try to tax them. So there's sort of informal probate and there's formal probate. And for people that really are wealthy, then I would suggest that they talk to special folks that design these crazy trusts that are possibly legal, that make the money go in a certain way and protect it from taxes and other kinds of things. But for general folks that can do a simple will, they're not that complicated. And there's some basic language that lawyers have used for years and that get approved by the courts, you know, for the most part, and they're not that hard.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today on Kids These Days, Stephen Pradell. It's great to have you in the studio and to speak with you.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Since 1976 in Alaska, youth ages 16 and older can be considered adults if they gain legal emancipation. Emancipation accelerates adulthood for kids who get it, allowing minors to sign for school and medical procedures, obtain housing through a lease, sue and be sued, basically be responsible for themselves in all aspects of their lives. Kids These Days contributor Paul Flav explains the basics of this not often utilized legal procedure.
At the Spinard Skate Park, teens grind rails, ollie, and get air on the half pipe with skateboards and BMX bikes, celebrating what to many is a sport that flaunts authority, celebrating the short time they have each day to do their own thing. Certainly these teens, given the opportunity, would want to make these moments more permanent and be outside parental control for, well, ever.
When you're 16, can you imagine taking care of yourself completely?
Not really. It's just a lot of hard work, a lot of bills to pay. And you have to have the right job and stuff.
No. No, I wouldn't have enough money to buy a house and everything.
No, I like being a kid.
No, because it would make my life worse because I'd be bad.
No. No, because it's kind of hard for me to save money and get a job.
Well, maybe not. While the urge to determine how they spend their time is great, actually being independently responsible holds little appeal for most of them. This might have to do with what goes into actually getting emancipated. As of 1994, a youth or parent of a youth who wants to emancipate must prove that they are a resident above the age of 16, that they are living separate from their parents or guardian, and are capable of supporting themselves, and they have to have the consent of their living parents. At 16, the idea of supporting yourself might boggle the mind, but this doesn't mean the subject isn't a popular one with teens.
I probably receive 3 phone calls a week regarding emancipation.
Heather Harris is executive director of the Alaska Youth and Parent Foundation, the foremost authority on assisting youth with emancipation in Alaska. Besides their informal guide to emancipation on their website, they counsel youth on what it means to be emancipated.
We've helped 5 teens in the last year go through the emancipation checklist to ensure that they had all of that information before they turned it into the court system.
According to Harris, youth AYPF have dealt with are looking to emancipate for everything from being unable to get along with parents and abuse in the home to trying to get federal student aid and early entrance into the military. But when they sit down with these teens, the youth's reaction to the paperwork is
overwhelming. It's a difficult, daunting process for teens to go through. A lot of times it's a learning experience for them to understand what it means to be an adult. A lot of teens are wanting the right to sign for school and those types of things and to become an adult, but sometimes they're not aware of all of the other pieces that come with being an adult.
So the process demands a youth who is on the ball, one that's ready to provide proof they are an adult, from being able to support themselves financially to having a plan for the future. And these are just the things youth have to get together before they file their petition of emancipation, which is a process that can take from 8 to 12 weeks. When you consider these things, it's easy to see how it goes from 3 calls a week to 5 in-center visits at Alaska Youth and Parent Foundation to finally the number of petitions filed, which is...
Since the beginning of 2006, we've done a total of 7. It's a very small number. My name's Catherine Yotis, and I'm the supervisor of the 3rd District Child Custody Investigator's Office. Of those, one is still pending. They have a hearing coming up. 4 have been granted. 1 was denied. And in one case, the minor never followed through with getting in all the paperwork they needed to do, so it was just closed.
Yotis feels that while this number's small, the process works the way it should.
We try to make it as easy as possible, but the burden is on them because that's part of showing responsibility. Can you get yourself to the courthouse, find the probate department, file the petition? Can you then make the phone call for the appointment and make it in to the appointment on time with the material you've been asked to bring? I mean, all of that shows some level of responsibility.
Yotis points out that it's rarely youth from extremely unstable home lives that end up seeking emancipation. She thinks those youth end up in state's custody through the Office of Children's Services and or the Department of Juvenile Justice. But this isn't always the case, says Heather Harris. Oftentimes, OCS is less engaged with youth who are nearing their 18th birthday.
The circumstance of a teen trying to get emancipated so that they have some kind of control over their life at 16 or 17, but then to also be able to document abuse or circumstances in their life is really difficult because at that point, OCS is really not as involved as they would be if the youth was younger. There's not a lot AYPF can do in that situation, and a lot of times it's a matter of a waiting game for youth till they're 18.
Despite this, Harris supports the process and has a little bit of advice for those thinking about emancipation.
I guess my best recommendation for teens trying to get emancipated is to really focus on the future. You have to look past your current situation and really be focusing on this is my job opportunity and how I'm going to continue to support myself.
For Kids These Days in Anchorage, I'm Paul Flev.
Today on Kids These Days, we debut another ongoing feature, our Ask KTD. Julia Jackson is a parent as well as a therapist and community counselor. She comes to us occasionally to answer questions that relate to the emotional issues families deal with. Today, Julia talks about the personal side of an all-too-common legal procedure that impacts families, divorce.
Divorce and separation is a commonly occurring trend in today's society. It is happening more and more frequently. It does affect every person involved. It's a whole other subject in terms of, you know, whether to keep the family together, what's better, to have the child around a couple that argues all the time or to have two positive adults but they have to share the household. Those are other issues that you might want to explore, but specifically talking about how do you deal with the emotional impact of what divorce and separation is doing with the kids? Well, think about how you deal with it. What helps you as you're going through this very, very difficult time in your life? Typically, it's very helpful when the other partner is polite and agreeable and gets along with you and makes things easier and doesn't have drama. Well, your kids are thinking the same thing. They acknowledge, they understand, they know what's going on. Children can read emotional behavior even if they can't hear what you're saying. And if you're talking about older children, they definitely know what's going on. They're hearing a lot more than you think that they are. So that's out of the way. Whether they know the full details is not really an issue. But how you react to the situation and how you react to the other partner is the issue. They're going to be watching that. They are going to be listening to how you talk about the other half of their DNA. You know, you're referring to the other part that created them, and all children identify with their parents and see things that they have from each parent. So if you're starting to bag on the other parent or mock them or talk about all of the horrible things that they're doing or all of the reasons why you left them, you're really causing that child to reflect on their own identity. You know, this husband or wife is a piece of them. And so what does that say about them? What does that say about their identity and how they picture themselves and how they accept themselves? So the first step that you have to do is say, okay, I'm divorcing. We're no longer in a marriage relationship, but you are still in a parent relationship. And that parent relationship is going to continue at minimum until the child is 18. I would suggest it's going to continue a little bit longer, because that child is going to have children. That child may be 35 years old and still need their parents and come running to both of their parents. So it's a parenting relationship. Yes, you've ended one type of relationship, but don't think that you're out of the relationship entirely. So in all of my couple sessions, what I said was, first decide whether the relationship is over, but then decide how and in what form it's going to continue. So as you pursue this new relationship of just parenting together, really consider how you talk to one another in front of the child, but also how you talk about the other partner in front of the child. And this is going to make things a lot easier on the child if they feel that the other person is still respected and accepted, because that's how they're going to feel about themselves.
Julia Jackson is a marriage and family therapist and community counselor. She appears as Ask KTD to answer your questions about children and the complex relationships we all have in our family lives. Julia works as the Director of Family Services at the statewide early childhood support organization THREAD. Julia says the book, Was It the Chocolate Pudding? By Sandra Levins, is an excellent resource for families who are dealing with divorce. You can find out more about that and about Ask KTD by visiting our website, that's kidsthesedays.org. If you have a question for Julia Jackson, write to mail@kidsthesedays.org. That's it for Kids These Days today. Thanks to our in-studio guest, attorney Stephen Pradel. Next time on the program, we're learning about sports in Alaska, find out how athletics can improve student achievement elsewhere, and learn about alternative ways Alaska youth get their exercise, whether that means a sweaty brow or a heated up brain. It's competitive youth sports next up on Kids These Days. Kids These Days had help today from our regular contributor, Jessica Cochran. Paul Flav reported from Anchorage. Julia Jackson is the woman behind Ask KTD. Sarah Gonzalez is our producer, technical director, and web editor. I'm your host, Shanna Sheehy. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
The ideas, opinions, and commentary you hear on Kids These Days are those of the hosts, guests, and contributors, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of its funders or broadcast partners. The Content Producers Guild is solely responsible for what you hear on the program. Kids These Days is made possible by a generous grant from the Association of Alaska School Boards and its Initiative for Community Engagement. Kids These Days is produced in partnership with KSKA 91.1 FM Anchorage, KRUA, and the UAA Department of Journalism and Public Communications.
Kids These Days!